Michael Courtney was in the city room of the Mail when the news that the appellate division had denied Moses Garmer's appeal and confirmed the date of his execution came clattering out on the tape. He let the paper strip run through his fingers, reading it with total concentration. And when the message ended, he went to his desk and sat in front of his typewriter. He lit a cigarette and sat quietly, staring out of the window over the tops of the scraggly trees in Joubert Park. He had a pile of work in his basket and a dozen reference books on his desk. Desmond Blake had slipped out of the office to go down to the George to top up his gin tank and left Michael to finish the article on the American elections. Eisenhower was nearing the end of his final term, and the editor wanted a pen portrait of the presidential candidates. Michael was working on his biographical notes of John Kennedy, but having difficulty choosing the salient facts from the vast amount that had been written about the young Democratic candidate, apart from those that everybody knew, that he was a Catholic and a New Dealer, and that he had been born in 1917. America seemed very far away that morning, and the election of an American president inconsequential in comparison with what he had just read on the tape. As part of his self-education and training, Michael made a practice each day of selecting an item of important news and writing a 2,000-word mock editorial upon it. The exercises were for his own sake, the results private and jealously guarded. He showed them to no one, especially not Desmond Blake, whose biting sarcasm and whose willingness to plagiarise Michael had learned to fear. He kept these articles in a folder in the locked bottom drawer of his desk. Usually, Michael worked on these exercises in his own time, staying on for an hour or so in the evening, or sitting up late at night in the little bedsitter he rented in Hillbrow, pecking them out on his rickety old second-hand Remington. However, this morning he had been so moved by the failure of Garmer's appeal that he could not concentrate on the Kennedy story. The image of the imperial-looking black man in his leopard-skin robes kept recurring before Michael's eyes, and his words kept echoing in Michael's ears. Suddenly he reached forward and ripped the half-completed page out of his machine. Then he swiftly rolled a clean sheet into it. He didn't have to think. His fingers flew across the keys, and the words sprang up before his eyes. A martyr is born. He rolled the cigarette to the side of his mouth and squinted against the spiral of blue smoke, and the words came in short staccato bursts. He did not have to search for facts or dates or figures. They were all there, crisp and bright in his head. He never paused. He never had to weigh one word against another. The precise word was there on the page almost of its own volition. When he finished it half an hour later, he knew that it was the best thing he had ever written. He read it through once, shaken by the power of his own words, and then he stood up. He felt restless and nervous. The effort of creation, rather than calming or exhausting him, had excited him. He had to get outside. He left the sheet in the typewriter and took his jacket off the back of his chair. The sub glanced up at him inquiringly. "Going to find Des," he called. In the newsroom there was a conspiracy to protect Desmond Blake from himself and the gin bottle, and the sub nodded agreement and returned to his work. Once he was out of the building, Michael walked fast, pushing his way through the crowds on the sidewalks, stepping out hard with both hands thrust into his pockets. He didn't look where he was going, but it didn't surprise him when at last he found himself in the main concourse of the Johannesburg railway station. He fetched a paper cup of coffee from the kiosk near the ticket office and took it to his usual seat on one of the benches. He lit a cigarette and raised his eyes towards the domed glass ceiling. The Pierneef murals were placed so high that very few of the thousands of commuters who passed through the concourse each day ever noticed them. For Michael, they were the essence of the continent, a distillation of all of Africa's immensity and infinite beauty. Like a celestial choir, they sang aloud all that he was trying to convey in clumsy, stumbling sentences. He felt at peace when at last he left the massive stone building. He found Des Blake on his usual stool at the end of the bar counter at the George. "Are you your brother's keeper?" Des Blake inquired loftily. But his words were slurred. It took a great deal of gin to make Des Blake slur. "The sub's asking for you," Michael lied. He wondered why he felt any concern for the man, or why any of them bothered to protect him. But then one of the other senior journalists had given him the answer to that. He was once a great newspaperman, and we have to look after our own. Des was having difficulty fitting a cigarette into his ivory holder. Michael did it for him, and as he held a match, he said, "Come on, Mr. Blake, they're waiting for you."
"Courtney, I think I should warn you, you know. You haven't got what it takes, I'm afraid. You'll never cut the mustard, boy. You're just a poor little rich man's son. You'll never be a newspaperman's anus."
"Come along, Mr. Blake," said Michael wearily, and took his arm to help him down off the stool. The first thing Michael noticed when he reached his desk again was that the sheet of paper was missing from his typewriter. It was only in the last few months, since he had been assigned to work with Des Blake, that he had been given his own desk and machine, and he was fiercely jealous and protective of them. The idea of anyone fiddling with his typewriter, let alone taking work out of him, infuriated him. He looked around him furiously, seeking a target for his anger, but every single person in the long, crowded, noisy room was senior to him. The effort it cost him to contain his outrage left him shaking. He lit another cigarette, the last one in his pack, and even in his agitation he realized that that made it 20 since breakfast.
"Courtney!"
the sub called across to him, raising his voice above the rattle of typewriters. "You took your time. Mr. Herbstein wants you in his office right away." Michael's rage subsided miraculously. He had never been in the editor's office before. Mr. Herbstein had once said good morning to him in the lift, but that was all. The walk down the newsroom seemed the longest of his life, and though nobody even glanced up as he passed, Michael was certain that they were secretly sniggering at him and gloating on his dilemma. He knocked on the frosted glass panel of the editor's door, and there was a bellow from inside. Timidly, Michael pushed the door open and peered round it. Leon Herbstein was on the telephone, a burly man in a sloppy, hand-knitted cardigan with thick, horn-rimmed spectacles and a shock of thick, curly hair shot through with strands of grey. Impatiently, he waved Michael into the room and then ignored him while he finished his conversation on the telephone. At last, he slammed down the receiver and swiveled his chair to regard the young man who was standing uneasily in front of his desk. 10 days before, Leon Herbstein had received a quite unexpected invitation to a luncheon in the executive dining room of the Courtney Mining and Finance Company's new head office building. There had been 10 other guests present, all of them leaders of commerce and industry, but Herbstein had found himself in the right-hand seat beside his host. Leon Herbstein had never had any great admiration for Shaza Courtney. He was suspicious of vast wealth, and the two Courtneys, mother and son, had a formidable reputation for shrewd and ruthless business practices. Then again, Shaza Courtney had forsaken the United Party, of which Leon Herbstein was an ardent supporter, and had gone across to the Nationalists. Leon Herbstein had never forgotten the violent anti-Semitism which had attended the birth of the National Party, and he considered the policy of apartheid as simply another manifestation of the same grotesque racial bigotry. As far as he was concerned, Shaza Courtney was one of the enemy. However, he sat down at his luncheon table quite unprepared for the man's easy and insidious charm and his quick and subtle mind. Shaza devoted most of his attention to Leon Herbstein, and by the end of the meal the editor had considerably moderated his feelings towards the Courtneys. At least he was convinced that Shaza Courtney truly had the best interests of all the people at heart, that he was especially concerned with improving the lot of the black and underprivileged sections, and that he was wielding an important moderating influence in the high councils of the National Party. In addition, he left the Courtney building with a heightened respect for Shaza Courtney's subtlety. Not once had Shaza mentioned the fact that he and his companies now owned 42% of the stock of Associated Newspapers of South Africa, or that his son was employed as a junior journalist on the Mail. It hadn't been necessary. Both men had been acutely aware of these facts while they talked. Up to that time, Leon Herbstein had felt a natural antagonism towards Michael Courtney. Placing him in the care of Des Blake had been all the preference he had shown to the lad. However, after that luncheon, he'd begun to study him with more attention. It didn't take an old dog long to attribute the improvement in much of the copy that Des Blake had been turning out recently to the groundwork that Michael Courtney was doing for him. From then onwards, whenever he passed Michael's desk, Herbstein made a point of quickly and surreptitiously checking what work was in his machine or in the copy basket. Herbstein had the journalist's trick of being able to assimilate a full typed sheet at a single glance. And he was grimly amused to notice how often Des Blake's column was based on the draft by his young assistant, and how often the original was better than the final copy. Now he studied Michael closely as he stood awkwardly before his desk. Despite the fact that he had cropped his hair in one of those appalling brush cuts that the youth were affecting these days, and wore a vividly patterned bow tie, he was a likeable-looking lad, with a strong, determined jawline and clear, intelligent eyes. Perhaps he was too thin for his height, and a little gawky, but he had quite noticeably matured and gained in self-assurance during the short period he had been at the Mail. Suddenly Leon realised that he was being cruel, and that his scrutiny was subjecting the lad to unnecessary agony. He picked up the sheet of typescript that lay in front of him and slid it across his untidy desk. "Did you write that?" he demanded gruffly, and Michael snatched up the sheet protectively. "I didn't mean anybody to read it," he whispered, and then remembered who he was talking to, and threw in a lame, "Sir." "Strange," Leon Herbstein shook his head. "I always believed we were in the business of writing so that others could read." "I was just practicing," Michael held the sheet behind his back. "I made some corrections," Herbstein told him. And Michael jerked the page out from behind him and scanned it anxiously. "Your third paragraph is redundant, and scar is a better word than cicatrice. Otherwise, we'll run it as you wrote it." "I don't understand, sir." "You've saved me the trouble of writing tomorrow's editorial." Herbstein reached across and took the page from Michael's limp fingers, tossed it into his out basket, and then concentrated all his attention on his own work. Michael stood gaping at the top of his head. It took him 10 seconds to realise that he had been dismissed, and he backed towards the door and closed it carefully behind him. His legs just carried him to his desk, and then collapsed under him. He sat down heavily in his swivel chair and reached for his cigarette pack. It was empty. He crumpled it and dropped it into his wastepaper basket. Only then did the full significance of what had happened hit him, and he felt cold and slightly nauseated. "The editorial," he whispered, and his hands began to tremble. Across the desk, Desmond Blake belched softly and demanded, "Where are the notes on that American, what's-his-name fellow?"
"I haven't finished it yet, Mr. Blake."
"Listen, kid, I warned you, you will have to extract your digit from your fundamental orifice if you want to get anywhere around here."
Michael set his alarm clock for 5 o'clock the next morning and went downstairs with his raincoat over his pyjamas. He was waiting on the street corner with the newspaper urchins when the bundles of newsprint were tossed onto the pavement from the back of the Mail's delivery van. He ran back up the stairs, clutching a copy of the paper, and locked the door to his bedsitter. It took all his courage to open it at the editorial page. He was actually shaking with terror that Mr. Herbstein might have changed his mind, or that it was all some monstrous practical joke. There, under the Mail's crest, at the very top of the editorial page, was his headline: "A Martyr is Born." He read it through quickly, and then started again and read it aloud, mouthing each word, rolling it over his tongue like a noble and precious wine. He dropped the paper, opened at the editorial, beside the mirror while he shaved, and then carried it down to the Greek fast-food cafe where he had his breakfast each morning, and showed it to Mr. Costa, who called his wife out of the kitchen. "Hey, Michael, you big shot now!" Mrs. Costa embraced him, smelling of fried bacon and garlic. "You are big shot newspaperman now!" She let him use the telephone in the back room, and he gave the operator the number at Velta Frieden. Santon answered on the second ring.
"Mickey!" she cried delightedly. "Where are you? Are you in Cape Town?"
He calmed her down and then read it out to her. There was a long silence. The editorial, Mickey? You aren't making this up, are you? I'll never forgive you if you are. Once he had reassured her, Santon told him, I can't remember ever being so excited about anything in years. I am going to call your father. You must tell him yourself. Sharza came on the line, and Michael read it to him. You wrote that? Sharza asked. Pretty hot stuff, Mickey. Of course, I don't agree with your conclusions. Gama must hang. However, you almost convinced me otherwise, but we can debate that when next we are together. In the meantime, congratulations, my boy. Perhaps you did make the right decision after all. Michael found that he was a minor celebrity in the newsroom. Even the sub stopped by his desk to congratulate him and discuss the article for a few moments. And the pretty little blonde on the reception desk, who had never before been aware of his existence, smiled and greeted him by name. Listen, kid, said Desmond Blake. One little fart doesn't make a whole sewage farm. In future, I don't want you pushing copy over my head. Every bit of shit you write comes across my desk. Get it? I'm sorry, Mr. Blake, I didn't... Yeah, I know you didn't mean it. Just don't go getting a big head. Remember whose assistant you are. The news of Moses Garmer's reprieve threw the newsroom into a state of pandemonium that didn't subside for almost a week. Michael was drawn in, and some of his days ended at midnight when the presses started their run and began when the first papers hit the streets the next morning. However, he found that the excitement seemed to release limitless reserves of energy in him, and he never felt tired. He learned to work quickly and accurately, and his way with words gradually assumed a deftness and polish that was apparent even to himself. 2 weeks after the reprieve, the editor called him into his office. He had learned not to knock. Any waste of time irritated Leon Herbstein and made him bellow aggressively. Michael went straight on in, but he had not yet entirely mastered the pose of world-weary cynicism, which he knew was the hallmark of the veteran journalist. And he was all radiant eagerness as he asked, Yes, Mr. Herbstein? Okay, Mickey, I've got something for you. Every time Mr. Herbstein used his Christian name, Michael still thrilled with delicious shock. We're getting a lot of requests from readers and overseas correspondents. With all the interest in the Gama case, people want to know more about the black political movements. They want to know the difference between the Pan-Africanist Congress and the African National Congress. They want to know who's who. Who the hell are Tambu and Sisulu, Mandela and Moses Gama? And what do they stand for? All that sort of stuff. You seem to be interested in black politics and enjoy digging around in the archives. Besides, I can't spare one of my top men on this sort of background stuff. So get on with it. Herbstein switched his attention back to the work on his desk, but Michael by now had sufficient confidence to stand his ground. Am I still working under Mr. Blake? He asked. He had learned by this time, if you called him sir, it just made Leon Herbstein mad. Herbstein shook his head, but did not even look up. You're on your own. Send everything to me. No hurry. Any time in the next 5 minutes will do nicely. Michael soon discovered that the Mail's archives were inadequate and served merely to initiate him into the complexity and daunting size of the project he had been set. However, from them he was at least able to draw up a list of the various black political groups and related associations such as the officially unrecognized black trade unions, and from there to compile a list of their own leaders and officials. He cleared one wall of his bed sitting room and put up a board on which he pinned all this information, using different coloured cards for each grouping and press photographs of the principal black leaders. All this achieved was to convince him of how little was known about the black movements by even the most well-informed of the white section of the nation. The public library added very little to his understanding. Most of the books on the subject had been written 10 or more years before, and simply traced the African National Congress from those distant days of its inception in 1912, and the names mentioned were all of men who were now dead or in their dotage. Then he had his first inspiration. One of the Mail's sister publications, under the banner of Associated Newspapers of South Africa, was a weekly magazine called Assegai, after the broad-bladed war spear that the impis of Shaka the Zulu conqueror had wielded. The magazine was aimed at the educated and more affluent section of the black community. Its editorial policy was dictated by the white directors of Associated Newspapers, but amongst the articles and photographs of African football stars and torch singers, of black American athletes and film actors, an occasional article slipped through of a fiercely radical slant. Michael borrowed a company car and went out to see the editor of Assegai in the vast black location of Drake's Farm. The editor was a graduate of the Black University of Fort Hare, a Xhosa named Solomon Nduli. He was polite but cool, and they had chatted for half an hour before a barbed remark let Michael know that he had been recognized as a spy for the security police and that he would learn nothing of value.